Wednesday and Friday, in which I shall attempt to suggest to you one possible way of making an order out of the complexities of the American religious scene. In trying to discuss the history of Christianity in America, one is presented with an extremely complex task. And it appears to me, at least, that to look at it theologically is not particularly productive, nor to try and define religion sociologically is not particularly productive. So what I'm suggesting is that one way of doing this, and it seems a bit better to me, is to take a look at the attitudes that the various religious groups that have appeared in this country have taken towards the culture. And I want to suggest basically three types of attitudes. The one we'll look at this morning is labeled paternalism, and the one on Wednesday, primitivism, and the one on Friday, which is perhaps more closely related to Holden Village, is that of utopianism. But in looking at these, I recognize that this is attempting to force upon a greatly varied religious complexity a simple scheme of things. But I hope that it will be somewhat helpful. During much of our history, especially during the colonial period, we continued the European tradition of a state church in this country. We have so taken religious freedom for granted that we seldom realize that during nearly half of our history, we lived under state churches. That is, we simply brought from Europe, and perhaps refined in some instances, the social pattern which taught that for there to be a workable civil and social order, there must be unified religious belief. And in fact, we had state churches in this country as late as 1833, when Massachusetts, the last state, finally disestablished the Congregational Church. However, the pattern never succeeded in this country, due in part to the fact that there were so many different groups that came, and also due perhaps more significantly to the fact of the tremendous space in America. And that has sort of dominated much of our motif in this country. We have always been able to go westward. There were great regions still to be conquered. And if you didn't want to abide by the religion of a given community, you could always move farther west. Massachusetts, they used to say in Boston, that our rigid religious structure here in no way imprisons you. Because if you can't abide by what we do, we simply give to you your enlargement. You are free to go live with the Indians. And if you survive, then you may develop your religion in that area beyond the borders of our commonwealth. Well, because of the space, because of the widely differing groups that came to settle here, a few of them actually emerging from the American soil, we do have, as in nowhere else in the world, this enormous religious complexity calling itself Christian in some way or other. Now, there are, as I'm suggesting to you, three basic ways in which this can be ordered: paternalism, primitivism, and utopianism. And I'd like to look today at paternalism. The paternalistic attitude draws very heavily from the name. It's the attempt to convey by the parents to their children the religion in which they were raised, and to convey it generation upon generation. That does not necessarily mean, however, that religion is static. It may indeed grow and mature. Because paternalists are a little bit like, if we may take it out of context, the biblical figure of the Pharisee. Phariseeism was often very strict, yet Phariseeism saw that each generation there were some new insights, and these new insights were incorporated. But nothing that had previously been incorporated was ever set aside. so that the tradition grew larger as you went through the generations. Never sloughed anything off, but just simply added to it. And in time, it all came to be seen as valuable and as important. Now, also what this paternalistic attitude suggests is that when one looks at a culture, one does not see it as a second Garden of Eden. That the story of man's fall in the first Garden of Eden has colored human nature for all time. And as settlers moved beyond the Appalachian Mountains in the early 19th century out into the Ohio River Valley and then into the Mississippi Valley, then into the Great Plains, these denominations looked upon this area as an area of tendencies toward barbarism. That when people uprooted themselves either from Europe or from the East Coast and moved westward, they left many things behind. And they came out into this area and started anew. And these religious groups felt that unless they consciously sought to bring with them the traditions in which they had been nurtured, the type of life that they would develop in the Far West, whatever that Far West may have been at the time that they moved, that what they developed would be less significant than what they had left behind. And so Horace Bushnell, in about the 1840s, a Connecticut theologian of some stature, one of the few Americans really of stature, wrote a book entitled Barbarism, the First Danger, in which he said that when someone moves from a settled territory to a frontier territory, it is usually the type of person who's dissatisfied. And often he consciously tries to leave behind that dissatisfaction in order that he may start anew. But when he goes out into the frontier and starts anew, consciously setting aside that in which he had been raised, he doesn't have much with which to begin. And not having much with which to begin, what he erects in that frontier society is not particularly humane. It takes a long time for him to put down new roots. In fact, it may take several generations. And in the meantime, human civilization is greatly depreciated. Now, with this kind of an attitude towards the American frontier, several denominations sought to answer it. And the paternalistically inclined denominations, I would suggest, are the Congregational Presbyterians, the Episcopalians, the Lutherans, and the Roman Catholics. Now, the Congregational Presbyterians in the early 19th century differed almost entirely in terms of institutional structuring, not in terms of an ideology. So we may really deal with them together. When the Congregationalists and Presbyterians came out onto the American frontier, they usually would send missionaries. And these missionaries would go out and seek to find only those who were of that persuasion. They looked only for their own kind. There was a report of some Congregational Presbyterian missionaries that was published in 1815 on the basis of a missionary journey through the frontier areas north of the Ohio. In the areas of Ohio, Indiana, Illinois, some of which were only territories at that time. And in the report, they write back and state that they didn't find any evidences of Christianity, completely ignoring the fact that they had met up with a great number of Methodist circuit riders. But to them, that did not represent Christianity. They were only looking for their own. They did not find their own. So what they sought to do in order to preserve this nation from falling into barbarism was to establish congregational Presbyterian communities in the forested and grassy plains of the Ohio-Mississippi River Valley. And when they would do this, they would send out a missionary to an area where they thought a town might indeed develop, and where they thought there was a chance for a cultured civilization to emerge. And they would send out this missionary and he would build a church. Hopefully, he would build a brick church, something of permanence, something of enduring, not some white frame building. Let the Methodists do that. But to build a solid structure, to give an indication of stability, to give an indication of culture. And he would serve just this one church. He would not ride around and preach into the log cabins or the saloons or under the trees. He would speak only in that one church. In addition to building the church, he would see to it that there would be quickly constructed a school. Because to him, what was necessary in the Ohio-Mississippi Valley was the development of a culture that included not only the way to worship, but included the whole panoply of education, church and school. But oftentimes it was very difficult for a Presbyterian or a Congregationalist to go out and find a community which gave some hope of being an existing community over a period of time. So what they would do frequently, and this had been happening in Western Europe since the Middle Ages, was to form a religious colony, to form a community, and getting together a number of families to go out into the virgin territory and buy up a sizable piece of land, and in the center of that piece of land to erect a village, and to pattern that village exactly after a New England or a New York town, and then to consciously become a beacon light in that wilderness, shedding the rays of truth and tradition in that area. And in so doing, they were only doing what their forebears had done. The Prestige Hill in Boston is probably still Beacon Hill. You have a Beacon Hill address, then you have a good address. But that idea emerged from the early Puritans, who, when they left England in the 17th century, came to Massachusetts Bay Colony to erect the Good Society. And once they had erected the Good Society, it would become so known that its reputation would carry all the way back to Old England. And they would then be invited home to do in England what they had not been permitted to do there, but what they had accomplished in New England. Well, now, New England in turn developed somewhat the same ideas, looking westward into the wilderness of the Ohio-Mississippi Valley to establish communities there in which all the traditions and all the customs of the Congregational way in New England or the Presbyterian way in New Jersey could be reincarnated in the Ohio-Mississippi Valley, and thus to save the nation from barbarism and to develop then a Yankee culture here in the West, whatever that West may mean. Now, it worked fairly well east of the Mississippi River. And it worked so well that the Congregationalists and Presbyterians agreed that if one would go to one town, the other would go to another town. And frequently, in communities in the Midwest still today, you will have either a Congregational or a Presbyterian church, but you will not have both. They carved up the area. And they also established a number of colleges in order to perpetuate this. So they worked out a methodology that was successful in the grassy and humid plains of the Mississippi and Ohio River valleys. But when they crossed the wide Missouri, these two denominations fell upon rather hard times. Basically, Congregationalists and Presbyterians did not settle in the Great Plains or in the Far West. They tended not to do that in any great numbers. And their methodology simply did not work. Because whereas communities would emerge in the grassy plains and forested plains of the Midwest, in the Great Plains it was very difficult to determine where a community would emerge. Especially since so many of these communities were mining communities, and they lasted only so long as the mines lasted, 15, 20 years, and then that was the end. And these denominations just simply were not able to put down roots. And there are still ghost towns in the Intermountain West which give evidences of the presence of these denominations, with these stone and brick churches that have not been inhabited by a soul for 50 to 75 years. gave out when the town gave out. So it didn't work too well here in the Great Plains and the Intermountain West, but it did in the Midwest. That was Presbyterians and Congregationalists to bring the New England way. Another denomination that sought to do this was the Episcopalian Church. The Episcopalian Church severed its connections with the Church of England after the American Revolution and created what is today the Protestant Episcopal Church in 1789, the same year as the Federal Constitution was put into effect. And there were those living in 1800 who said that the Episcopal Church wouldn't survive the generation that now belonged to it. That by the time you got to 1820, or certainly by the time you arrived at 1850, there no longer would be an Episcopalian church in this country. Because it just simply wasn't American. It was too tied to the British. Well, the Episcopal Church nearly died. But with some British tenacity of muddling through, it survived the first generation after the Revolution. But by the 1820s and 1830s, the episcopacy became reinvigorated. And it became reinvigorated particularly when it developed a new idea of its purpose, of its function. And that occurred in the early 1830s when the Episcopal Church decided that the denomination itself was a mission society. That missions did not belong to the women in the church. There wasn't to be some women's missionary federation. That the very denomination was a mission society. And in so doing, it developed this kind of a mission methodology that certainly made episcopacy far more evident in the Intermountain and Far West than it was to be in the Midwest. Because in the Episcopal Church, it has a heavy concentration on the East Coast. It has a rather minor presence in the Midwest. It has a much heavier presence in the Great Plains and in the Far West. And the reason for that is that when in 1830 they decided that the whole denomination was a missionary society, they then sent to the frontier bishops. And the bishop would come out, locate sites for the erection of brick churches, send back east to wealthy members of the denomination for money to build the church and to pay young clergymen who were considered to be a bit rebellious to fit into the established church on the East Coast to come out and make it in the West. And the result of which is that Episcopal churches in many Western communities were the first churches in town. And they were well built, and they were well staffed. And the Episcopal presence became known. One drives across South Dakota, one finds what one would not expect to find, and that is one Episcopal church after another on the Indian reservations. Now, you would not find that in Ohio or Indiana or Pennsylvania, but you will find it in the Great Plains. When the denomination decided that it itself was a missionary society, and it went out with the presence of a bishop and started the church from the top down with its full presence. Well, that was the Episcopal way then in creating a paternalistic attitude and incorporating that into religious institutions. And it is strange to see, as one looks at the western part of the United States, to see these very English-looking church buildings on the American frontier. Now you can see that, whether it's in Iowa, or you can see that on Nob Hill in San Francisco, where the dominant church is the Episcopal Cathedral. But the Lutheran story, and that's the one perhaps with which we're most familiar, is certainly a paternalistic point of view. Lutheranism, when it emerged in this country, was initially German and Swedish primarily. The Swedes settled along the banks of the Delaware River in colonial Pennsylvania and New Jersey and built their church in their little colonies. And the Swedish pastor wrote back in the long before the American Revolution, wrote back to Sweden and said that when a Swede comes to church here in America, and he closes his eyes. For a while, he is sure that he's back in Sweden, that the sounds are the same as that he would hear in a Swedish church. He was trying to reincarnate then Swedish religion on the American frontier with no loss at all. German Lutherans that came to this country before the revolution tended to be in the main pietists, coming out of the University of Halle, which was sort of a mission school that had developed in Germany. Henry Melchior Muhlenberg, sort of the patriarch of American Lutherans, was a product of that school. And the Lutheranism that developed here was not like the Lutheranism back in Germany, pietistically inclined instead. But once that pietism lost its fervor, it became replaced by a very rationalistic religion. And that then became the dominant motif in Pennsylvania. But as one comes into the 19th century, this Lutheran story changes. And it's basically due to conditions in Germany. In 1817, the Prussian king decided that in his domain there was only going to be one Protestant church. And so by ruler's fiat, he decreed that those of the Calvinist tradition and those of the Lutheran tradition must worship together as one church. And then he drew up for them a liturgy which they must observe. And there are a few things that rile the pew as a change in the liturgy does, especially if it's a change in the liturgy that's ordered by the government. Now, there were those in Germany who would not observe this new liturgy. And there were those in Germany who were afraid that pure Lutheranism was going to be lost if it was forcibly mixed with the Calvinist tradition. And these people, a number of them, found no escape except to leave the country. And so German Lutheran immigrants began to come to this country with a very stubborn theological tenacity to preserve pure Lutheranism. And they began to settle, some of them around Buffalo, New York, others up around Milwaukee, Wisconsin, others around Dubuque, Iowa, some around Columbus, Ohio, and then the largest single group of them, under perhaps the most brilliant leadership of C.F.W. Walther, in St. Louis and Perry County, Missouri. And this changed the whole tenor of Lutheranism in this country. It became more decidedly Lutheran. If you mean by that not the teachings of Martin Luther, but how that man who wasn't very structured in his thought was organized by the theologians of the 17th century, and Luther was made to conform to an order. It was that kind of Lutheranism that then came to the fore. And this confessional Lutheranism caught on not only here in the Midwest and in farther west, but also began to change the character of the Pennsylvania Lutherans, so that they became more 17th century Lutheran Orthodox. Result of this is then that Lutheranism became very conscious of its own peculiarities and sought to pass this on from one generation to the next. And it did so because it became the religion of the catechism. Lutheranism could be taught. It could be memorized. It could be carried on year after year, generation after generation. And the Lutherans were quick to develop schools to see to it that this was done. Particularly the Germans would develop their schools so that their kids would go to German parochial schools, where they would learn not only Lutheranism, but they would learn German culture, and this would be carried on. The Swedes never developed, really, a school system that could compete with the American public schools, but the Swedes instead developed what they called summer schools. The Norwegians did the same. They had these summer schools that would last for 5-6 weeks in the summertime. And the kids would be expected to go to Swede school or Norwegian school. And there they would learn the hymns, they would learn the catechism, and they would learn the Bible. So that the religion then was transmitted from one generation to the next, not only in theological purity, but in the original language. And there are still many of a German background or of a Scandinavian background who now in their 70s and 80s can remember having learned the Bible, having learned the hymns, having learned the catechism in some European language. And even though maybe for the last 50 years they've been going to English services, they never really have been to church. They've simply been going to meetings, because there is the soul language which can never be translated. And they still fall back upon those hymns, those Bible passages, and that catechism in the language in which they had originally learned it. This is the paternalism. To a certain extent, Lutheranism is backing off of this now as it becomes more Americanized. I suppose it's particularly backing off with it with regard to confirmation, because confirmation right now seems to be something that's sort of hanging in the balance, and nobody really knows where it's going. But I can remember going to a German community near Quincy, Illinois, a few years ago during an interim, and we would, members of the religion department at Augie would take turns occupying the pulpit, so that we only had to go down one Sunday a month, because it was about 200 miles round trip. So we'd go down one Sunday, and I happened to be there the Sunday before confirmation. And they'd had a lay catechist in the congregation preparing the kids in this German community for Lutheran confirmation. And so what they did on that Sunday before confirmation was they got up, they had a microphone set in the chancel of the church, and the kids all dressed, and the girls in their white dresses, and the fellows in their new suits, and they got up before that microphone and to that packed church recited Luther's small catechism from page one to page end. They knew every word of the catechism, and they could spell it out without missing a syllable. That was how they had been prepared. That is Lutheran paternalism. That is passing on, without any diminution, the religion of the fathers. This is a concern, then, that a culture, that a faith go on. It's memorizable, it's transmittable. And once it's implanted, it will never really ever be forgotten. This type of thing. But perhaps the most paternalistic of all the denominations, and the one that is by far the largest in the United States today, is the Roman Catholic Church. The Roman Catholic Church's history in this country is unlike any other religious organization. Catholicism has not had a very easy time of it at all. In fact, it's had a very difficult time. In 1800, there were hardly any Roman Catholics in this country. Just a smattering across the colonial scene and the new states. By 1850, it was the largest single denomination in this country. What had happened? Primarily, it was a potato famine in Ireland that got it all started. Ireland simply emptied itself of its people in the 1830s and 1840s and 1850s. Many of them came to the United States. Thousands of them crossed the Irish Sea into England. And still, in the west of England, in Cornwall and Wales and Glasgow, on the west side of Scotland, there are thousands and thousands of Irish Catholics. And the English hate them with an intense passion. Not only in Northern Ireland is the problem, but throughout Great Britain, there is the English dislike of the Irish Catholic. This country has had the same thing, only it has diminished here now somewhat in more recent decades. But the Irish came. And in the 40s and 50s, they settled in the rural sections of the country. And there are in the Midwest communities that are very Irish Catholic. Other times you'll find communities that are German Catholic. But the Irish and the German, while they were disliked, were not disliked at all, like were the later Roman Catholic immigrants that came from Eastern and Southeastern Europe after the Civil War, particularly in the 1880s up to the turn of the 20th century. Then came the Italians. These Catholics came after sort of the American frontier closed. 1890, Frederick Jackson Turner said it closed. And they had to settle in the cities. And the Catholics became ghetto communities in the industrial cities. And they were poor people, and they worked for the Protestant tycoons, the Rockefellers, the Goulds, the Drews, the Vanderbilts. And in working for these people, they were exploited. They worked very cheaply, and they lived in tenements. And the church became very socially conscious with regard to its membership. And the Roman Catholic Church became identified with social movements. Protestants did not support the nascent labor movement in this country. The Roman Catholic Church did. And the major Roman Catholic leader, Cardinal Gibbons of Baltimore, when he received his cardinal's hat in Rome, pleaded with the Pope that the Pope not condemn labor unions in America. He was condemning them in all of Europe, and he condemned them in Canada. But the Pope did not condemn the American labor movement. He didn't approve of it. He simply tolerated it. And this way, the church became identified with the economic concerns of the poor Catholic immigrants. And in so doing, the church became identified with the immigrants. And whereas Swedes came to this country in considerable numbers, the vast majority of them said, to hell with the church. And only a minority retained any religious connections. But in the Roman Catholic immigrants, there was no appreciable loss. They became more Catholic in this country than they had been in Europe, because the church stood by them to gain civil rights, to gain economic rights, to improve their social lot. This brought down the hatred of the Protestant community upon American Catholicism. But Catholic paternalism was enhanced in this country because the church became the vehicle by which the immigrant retained his identity and his dignity. And so in large urban centers, ethnic Catholic parishes developed. The Italian parish, the Irish parish, the German parish, the Polish parish. And whereas they conducted their services in Latin, nonetheless they maintained all their cultural habits and customs. A Polish wedding is far different than an American wedding. But they kept alive these traditions, so that they became more Italian than they had been in Italy, or they became more Polish than they had been in Poland. But it was the church that was the vehicle by which they maintained their integrity. So this is what I'm suggesting to you is essentially paternalistic religion in this country. It's a religion which makes the point that you as an individual have your experience with God through the forms of your forefathers. You are not the free spirit who's going to go out and have a personal experience, except that that will come to you through regularized, established channels. Now, this is not the dominant American religious motif. That's primitivism that we'll look at on Wednesday. But this is the form with which probably those of us in this room are the most familiar, that we conform to the traditions of our elders. And it's true whether you're Episcopalian, you're Congregational, Presbyterian, Lutheran, or Roman Catholic. There is an attitude here which is not particularly trustworthy of the individual, but insists upon the norm. But as I mentioned a few moments ago, it's not necessarily a static norm. It's a little bit like an English organist told me when my family and I were in Europe last spring and summer, that you take a look at a cathedral organ. It is an enormous instrument. But it originally began as a rather small instrument. But the tendency in Europe is that when you engage an organist, you engage a brilliant young man, and he holds that position for his entire career. He may be organist in that church for 40, 50 years. During that 40 or 50 years, the organ is reconstructed to his tastes so that he may play contemporary music on that organ. When he retires, he is replaced by another individual who may likewise stay a quarter of a century or a half century. During his time, the organ is again reconstructed so that it is brought up to date to play contemporary music. And when this goes on over a period of three or four generations, you get an enormous instrument. But you can play the entire literature of church music on that part of the instrument that was particularly designed for it. Now, this is when I say, taking out of context, is Phariseeism that has to do with paternalism. It's a tradition that never drops anything, but slowly adds what seems to be contemporarily relevant and incorporates this relevance into the established tradition so that the tradition is ever growing but is also at the same time solidified. Now, the one problem for Lutheranism in all of this is that Lutherans like to follow Martin Luther to some extent anyway. Martin Luther himself sometimes claimed to be a follower of the Apostle Paul. And if you recall from any of your biblical studies, the Apostle Paul was in no way a traditionalist. He was a very free-spirited individual. And so there's a constant tension in Lutheranism between the free-spirited person having to operate within the walls of a solid tradition. But in this way, the Episcopal Church and the Lutheran Church and Roman Catholicism have been able to retain an identifiable quality, while at the same time slowly incorporating new ideas, so that what the Father passes on to the Son is not much different from what he received from his father before him. That's paternalistic religion. Now, on Wednesday, we'll take a look at the primitivist side, which goes in a quite different direction, and which suggests that religion, Christianity, has become distorted when it has been encased in cultural accretions, and that the object of Christian faith should be to hack away at all these traditions that have emerged and get back to the plain, pure, simple Bible, which each individual perceives because of the direct inspiration of the Holy Spirit. And so, and the one that I like most with regard to the primitivists is the Disciples of Christ, called the Christian Church, which started out in the first decade of the 19th century in the Kentucky wilderness under this theme, the restoration of the ancient order of things, and to do so along this motif, where the Bible speaks, we speak, and where the Bible is silent, we are silent, to restore primitive Christianity in its simplicity and to build a religious community around these simple truths. That is quite different than what you will go by attending the Book of Common Prayer in the Anglican Church, which has such a heavy English tradition of the centuries, or what you will find in a Congregational and Presbyterian church, which may reflect very strongly the developments of New England and New York as they have come into this part of the country, or in Lutheranism, which will be using a liturgy that is only a variant of the Roman Catholic liturgy that goes back into the early Middle Ages as a continuum by which the community of faith has sought to worship God. One thing that impressed me last night at the Eucharist was that it's been a long time
in going to a Lutheran church that I have seen the red book used in its purity. And that was one thing that has struck me about the West. For 4 summers we lived in Southern California. We went to an ALC church in Thousand Oaks, Ascension Lutheran. And when I worshiped in that church, I dropped back 30 years to when I was a teenager in Northern Iowa. I have not seen Lutheranism in the Midwest for 30 years worship the way this church in Southern California did. I wonder if this says something about Lutheranism in the far West. It's conscious of the tradition, very conscious of the tradition, and has not maybe incorporated some of the newer additions that the churches in the Midwest have now sought to bring in to the greater tradition. But this idea that slowly we grow, but basically we hang on to that which we have. Paternalism. Faith of the fathers living still. If you have any questions or comments, I'd be pleased to attempt to respond to them with regard to this form of the of religious observance. Yes.
Now you didn't bring in at all the largest group in the United States right now, the Southern Baptists, the Baptists.
That's because they're coming on Wednesday, as they're strong examples of primitivism, where there is the conscious effort not to perpetuate some European culture at all, but to create in the Garden of Eden, America, a new kingdom of God on the basis solely of the scripture and the ever presence of the Holy Spirit directly mediated to the individual.
On Wednesday, will you get into those other elements, Swedish traditions? I mean, like the mission?
Well, the primitivist denominations, I could just suggest, are primarily the Methodists, and you will find your Swedish Methodists, the Baptists, and you'll have your Swedish Baptists, the Disciples of Christ, and the one that I think is most American and most primitive of all, but which probably we would not even recognize as Christian. And that's the Church of Jesus Christ of the Latter-day Saints. And the term itself is suggestive of primitivism, Latter-day Saints, suggesting that Christianity went askew once it became part of the Roman Empire in the 4th century and was only restored by Joe Smith Jr. in 1830, based upon a new revelation that complemented the old revelation. And you begin anew consciously, eliminating traditions.
You made another statement about the difference in worship in the Midwest. What did you mean? They do more variations of different forms of worship?
Yeah, and what I'm suggesting is that the Lutheran churches of which I'm familiar in the Midwest will use the Red Book, but have now supplemented it with other worship additives. And I was struck last night by the fact that there were no additives. It was the Red Book. And what has happened in the Midwest is that many times we have lost the integrity of worship. We have so many additives that the whole thing gets to be kind of a mishmash. And there was an integrity last night. And at this church in Southern California, Ascension Lutheran, there simply were no additives. It was the Red Book, but there were certain traditions, like every time they had a baptism, they sang "He that believes and is baptized," which belonged to the old Norwegian Lutheran Church, the ELC. I think it was the standard baptismal hymns for generations. And they used certain, the Gloria Patri, they used a particular tune to that, that perhaps was not the Red Book tune, but was the old Norwegian tune. And it was clear that in that mix of Southern California, where you have such a vast variety of religious expressions, here was the congregation that was explicitly determined to retain the roots out of which its membership had come.
Well, what about the contemporary services then that the Lutheran churches are using?
This is where the experimentation is going on to see whether or not these are going to become part of the tradition. These paternalistic churches may be extremely experimental. They will try many things. A few of them eventually will be incorporated. The rest will be sloughed aside. But Lutheranism doesn't go chasing a new order of service. And that becomes the new order. And then 15, 20 years later, they come up with another one that's entirely different. Your primitivist type denomination may do that. And so, say, in a Methodist church, one who has been a member of a congregation, say, for 50 years, may tell you that the congregation has gone through actually 3 or 4 different lifetimes during that half century. It's had different theologies, it's had different worship. It's really been a series of congregations that have happened to meet in the same place. But in Lutheranism, if you belong to it for a half century, there is the solid trunk which is still there. It has been one congregation, and it may have tried different things at different times. It will include that which it finds lasting, it will exclude that which it does not incorporate into its tradition, but once incorporated, it remains forever.
Myron, you spoke about changing attitudes toward confirmation in the Lutheran Church and the confirmation instruction. And in our own congregation, my family's part, there's not a very clear idea about what ought to constitute confirmation instruction. Is this a sign that the paternalistic character of the Lutheran Church is diminishing now, or would you interpret it differently?
I would say I would see it as a decline in paternalism in favor of theology. Lutheranism technically has 2 sacraments. At least it wants to tell every Roman Catholic it has 2 sacraments, and that it chucked 5 Roman Catholic sacraments. Actually, in Lutheranism, we have 4 sacraments. We have communion and we have baptism. But we also have the sacrament of the pulpit, because the pulpit is very important in Lutheran churches. The sermon is a major ingredient of the worship experience. The pew demands the pulpit. Not all clergymen see the pulpit as that important, but the pew tends to see the pulpit as very important. So we do have the sacrament of the pulpit. And then we do have the sacrament of confirmation. Now that is a pew sacrament, that's not a theological sacrament. And the reason that we have the sacrament of confirmation is, I think, because it's part of the tradition. It meant much in Europe. It signified a boy coming of age. You wear long pants now, you got a watch, you can have a job. He was now a man. It sort of represented one of the stages in life's journey. And that's what religious ceremonies celebrate, the stages in life journey. And this was the stage in which he became an adult. And that has been brought over into America.
Does it come from Judaism, or they have bar mitzvah?
They have bar mitzvah in Judaism. You find it in many religions, I think, where you mark the stages of life. And the communists have taken this. You know, East Germany, heavily Lutheran, such an emphasis on confirmation. The communists quickly came up with a parallel. And now communism in Eastern Europe has a parallel. You have the christening, the name giving. You have the confirmation into the youth group. You have marriage. You have burial. The communist government has paralleled the Christian church in developing ceremonial occasions to observe the passages in life's journey. And confirmation is one of those pew sacraments that marks this passage from childhood to young adulthood. And now the teachers of the church are saying, let's remember that in Lutheran teaching, a sacrament is related to something that Jesus said, and that confirmation really was something that the pew had created. You know, Luther did not have confirmation. He dropped it. It was picked up a century later and became a dominant part. Not long ago, no matter how tenuous parents' relationship to the church was, they would have a relationship during the 2 years, 1 year or three, of confirmation, because it was a necessary part of the culture. And the confirmation itself can be a religious event, or it may be, more importantly, a family event, calling for a big dinner, presents, new clothes. It's this type of thing.
We were in Spokane last Sunday. The Lutheran church there had had confirmation, and it was individual.
Mm-hmm.
There were 12 members that day. There had been two the Sunday before. There were still two coming, and they were leaving it up to the child and the parent to decide when that child was ready. They also had sponsors.
50 years from now, it's going to be kind of hard to call the confirmation class together for a church anniversary. But now, when a church has an anniversary, it's not hard to bring the confirmation classes together to celebrate it. Talking to some German pastors in England last spring about confirmation, the German churches are going through much of what the American Lutheran churches are doing in trying to define confirmation. And this German pastor told me that the time spent in confirmation had been reduced to either 1 year or hopefully 2 years. And they tried to separate the religious aspect from the family cultural aspects. And there were two ways they could do this. One would be to admit a child to communion after 1 year of confirmation instruction. Germans have no tolerance for this fifth grade thing that we Americans have. But they would admit them to communion after 1 year. Or they would admit them to communion at a special service on the Saturday before confirmation, so that on the Saturday before, the parents' sponsors would go to a communion service, which would be the first communion for the child. And then on the next day, when the public rite was observed before the hundreds of people jamming the churches, they could go home and have their big family dinners. And that was cultural. And so he said, one thing that we have done is we have separated First Communion from confirmation. But we have not made the year separation that you have in the United States. They have not adopted the 1910 Roman Catholic American idea that confirmation ought to be when one is about fifth grade. I mean, the Lutherans have simply aped what the Roman Catholics did shortly after the turn of the century. But they said the Germans have made the separation because they've tried to separate them, the religious from the cultural aspects, recognizing that confirmation in many ways is a cultural thing, but have not gone quite the directions that we in America have done.
Well, in the past, it's always thought that confirmation is the end of a learning period. Is there any attempt to straighten that up? We still have a problem in education, too, that you don't graduate. That's the beginning of maturity, when it should go on and on and on and on.
Well, that's my understanding of what the present idea of confirmation in the Lutheran Church in this country is. That if there is a public ritual, it simply is a point in the lifelong learning process. It is not the graduation ceremony. And that's what they're attempting to do. And also to sort of undergird this, to have separated communion from it, because communion is an experience, not an understandable event anyway. So having it at an earlier time. But when you have a paternalistically inclined denomination, it's very hard to root out that which is essentially a cultural accretion, but which has, in the long process of time, become part of the very root of the tradition. And this is one of the areas where it becomes most to the fore, is the question of confirmation and the whole attitude towards sacraments.
Seems to be one of the dangers of the paternalistic religions like Lutheranism is that the way we honor our traditions is to develop, to sort of ritualize the service such that we can in fact mimic it Sunday after Sunday. And how do then it becomes difficult to make that a personal experience to sort of bring the essence with you rather than just the form?
If you're a free spirit, you have a little problem there, because it really does call for you to conform to the group. Whereas if you're a Methodist or a Baptist, you don't have that particular problem. Trouble is, you may not have the form to conform.
But even in conforming, I think there's a danger in just sort of going along with the crowd and sort of losing maybe the sense of what that tradition was all about in the first place.
Well, that's I would say, if you want to tie that and you to say the liturgy, that's because our liturgy was written by Americans. If we'd allowed the English to write it, you wouldn't have that problem. Because the beauty of the English language in the Book of Common Prayer is an aesthetic experience. And you do not have that sense of rote. I think we do not have the beauty of language in American. And this is part of the problem. We've lost the poetry. On the other hand, you can particularize the liturgy so that it addresses the person next to you and maybe one three rows behind you, but really says nothing to you. Now, how can you develop a liturgy that can yet be specific to the individual, but yet incorporate the feelings of the entire community?
Now, C.S. Lewis argued that it should become so rote that you're not concerned with the mechanics of liturgy, where it is informed, but it is so rote that you are there with your mind centered on God and why you're in the first place. That's your other argument for not introducing all the new, because he said, well, I never think about that. He doesn't think you should think about that.
Well, that requires the beauty of the English language to do that, and the aesthetics of worship. I think we heard a bell, didn't we? Coffee time?
Coffee break. Thank you, Myra.